Santa Rita Hills on a glorious sunny day, and we're at Claude Pepe Estate with owner Stephen Pepe. And Stephen's written an interesting book about Claude Pepe, and it's titled A Vigneron's Quest for Great Dirt. And we're going to sit down and talk with Stephen today about his background, how he got into wine, how he ended up in the Santa Rita Hills, and how he came to write this book. Thanks for sitting down with us, Stephen, and maybe we'll just start back a number of years and how you got interested in wine and how you ended up where you are now.
Well, great, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Well, I'm an Italian second generation, and my grandparents, who came over from Naples in the early 1900s, made homemade wine with their other Italian compatriots in Paterson. And they would go to Newark, and the grapes would come in lug boxes, and nobody remembers where they came from. My guess is they're probably from California, probably Petite Syrahs or Zins, and they would go through and taste the grapes and decide which lug boxes they wanted and would load up their cars and trucks and take them home and make a barrel of wine. And then when they got time to bottle it, they'd go from house to house tasting everybody's wine, and as Italians are wont to do, arguing about whose wine was the best and whether this year was better than last year and those sorts of things. And so I sort of grew up in that environment, and I've always had an interest in wine. Never really got very much into distilled spirits other than an occasional cognac or Armagnac, but that's how I've always enjoyed wine. My father always drank wine at the dinner table, and wine was always a part of my growing up.
So, I'm just curious here. This is sort of a story I hear all the time. There's a common thread here with Italian people. They love wine. They're all into wine. They all make homemade wines and so on and so forth. So it sounds like your family wasn't any exception in this regard.
No, they weren't. They were very, it was very common because they were farmers. They came from Naples, and you know, one of the things you did when you were a farmer was you made wine, because before we had all the refrigeration, everything we had, and the calories in the winter was a issue with making sure you had enough calories to keep you going, and wine was one way that you could get 300 or 400 calories fairly easily when you didn't have a lot of other foodstuffs around to supply, or the foodstuffs you had were things like potatoes and things of that nature, which are not that nutritious.
So, where'd you grow up, Steve, and how did you end up in California?
Born in Paterson, New Jersey, and then went to Hawthorne, which is a suburb, in the fifth grade, and through Hawthorne High School. And then I went to Montclair State College in Upper Montclair, New Jersey, which is the home of the Yogi Berra Museum, for those of you who didn't know that. And then from Montclair, I went to Duke Law School. And then from Duke Law School, I came out to L.A. in 68 with O'Melton and Myers, and worked there for 35 years. Seven as associate, 28 as a partner, and retired in 2004.
And when did you start Claude Pepe?
Well, we started Claude Pepe South, which we referred to in the book as Amateur Hour, in 1992. I had been divorced in the late 80s, and Catherine was one of the other partners in our law firm, and met her, and we got married in 92, and she had this small 1940s tract home in Long Beach, and there's a side yard on it that they used to use for drying clothing, and I said to her, do you mind if I plant the side yard? She said, no, so I put in about 50 vines, mostly Pinot Noir and some Sauvignon Blanc, and had the largest and oldest and only vineyard in Long Beach, and we started making homemade wine from our grapes that we produced there.
Have you had any experience with planting grapes or tending grapes or anything like that?
The answer is no, and that's one of the things that the book our trials and tribulations, or as Catherine said, I stayed one chapter ahead in the Davis textbook on how to grow grapes, and it was a learning experience. I made all the common mistakes home vineyardists and winemakers make. You plant too many varieties, and then you plant the varieties you like to drink as opposed to what's going to grow there. And so that's one of the reasons we only do two grapes up here, which are Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
And what did you do along with
you? We did Cabernet Franc, we did Pinot Noir, we did Nebbiolo, we did Sauvignon Blanc, and a little Chardonnay.
Now, without meaning to sound cheated, what survived?
The Pinot Noir did pretty well, and then after we sold the house, we sold it to two doctors who didn't drink wine, so I suspect the vineyard has long since disappeared.
I wouldn't have thought that Pinot Noir would do that well that far south, but apparently it did.
Well, it depends how you define it well. It made a wine, and in some of my winemaking faux pas are in there, that in the book when you can read about it. One year, I didn't have quite enough wine to top the barrel, and so I said, the wine was looking a little thin, and didn't have as much body, so I had a little bottle of 20 port will help it out. County home winemakers competition.
So, Steve, how did you start to come up to this region, Santa Rita Hills?
Well, if you're making homemade wine, one of the problems that home winemakers have is finding decent grapes. And the fellow I started making it with was started off using concentrate, and then he was getting grapes, Zinfandel, from out in the Cucamonga area, which was okay, but not great. And so we had been up here to the valley a number of times. And so I started asking around and ran across Jeff Newton, who was planted most of the San Ynez Valley, and told him I was looking for grapes, and he seemed somewhat interested. And so he arranged for us to pick grapes at the Valley View Vineyard, which is over on 246 in Alamo Cantata. Ganey, we picked right next to where the airplanes landed. We also picked some at Stolten. So we would get about 1,200 pounds, a little over half a ton, because that's what you need to make a 60-gallon barrel of wine, have a little for topping. So we had done that for 4 or 5 years. And then I told Jeff I was interested in Pinot Noir. And he said, well, if you want to do Pinot Noir, you've got to be west of the 101 freeway over in what is now called the San Rita.
There was no Santa Rita Hills per se at that point in time, but there was sort of a burgeoning breakthrough in Pinot Noir out here.
Yes, there was. At the point in time when we bought in 1954, there were 3 wineries and 6 vineyards, and all of those had been in the 1970s or 80s, and we were one of the first in the 1990s, and as a side note, we drove up and down 246 in Santa Rosa and all the vineyards you now see and some of our vineyards we looked at and bid on, got outbid by llama farmers, drilled a dry hole in one place. We are going to buy what is now the Melville vineyard. The farmer wanted to sell, but he wanted to wait until he got more land down on the Santa Rosa Road, and this property came on, so we bought this one instead. And after we done that, Catherine said to me, I'm sure glad we didn't get what is now the Melville property. And I said, why is that? I said, remember that house in the back of the property? I said, yeah, it was a nice ranch house. Been great for retirement. We didn't have to build anything. She said, yeah, it's a nice 1950s ranch house, and it's too nice to tear down, but not nice enough to retire to. And so that's how we didn't end up with Melville, and she was quite happy. As you can see, this place is a little bit more substantial than the 1950s ranch house.
So you bought the property in what year?
Well, 1994. It was a horse ranch. We bought it in 1994, and it was a horse ranch and had a bunch of fences and pastures and all that sort of stuff, and Jeff Newton was kind enough to help us develop it. And he said, well, you got to get rid of all these fences and pastures and all this sort of stuff. And I was looking around trying to figure out how to get rid of it. And one of the things I noticed, which I thought was kind of strange, that all the fences had this wire on, and I couldn't figure out why you fences, and holes in the fences are doing is keeping the horses in. I found out that what happens is if you don't put wire on the wood, the horses eat the wood, and that the wire is very valuable. In those days, it was like about $1 a foot. And so I started asking around what to do with this wire, and this local farmer said, well, let me keep the wire. I'll pull out all the fences and get rid of the fence posts for you and everything else. And so he and his father and his wife and his two kids would come most weekends, and the guys, the men would pull out the fence posts, and the kids would be pulling the staples out of the wire and rolling it up and carting it away. So a little barter economy worked very well. He was more than pleased to do all that, and he really thinks that he got the better part of the deal. And at the same time, I also, the prior horse owner had sown a lot of seed for hay for the horses to eat. And then just, so we got rid of all this hay, and I had this whole field of hay out there, and I wanted to do that. So I talked to the same farmer, and he said, well, if you let me keep it, I'll come in here and take it off. So he comes in with his equipment and bales it all up, and then I found out subsequently bale hay was worth about $8 or $9 a bale. He pulled about 30 or 40 out of the property, and he was quite happy, and I was quite happy, but more barter economy.
Country boy, city boy.
Yeah. I think I probably got taken advantage of in one sense, but on the other hand, I was glad that to have somebody get rid of it. We were working in L.A. and only up here on a weekend, so it really wasn't something we could do.
Was it hard for you to manage that kind of thing? You've still got a life and a career, both of you, down in Long Beach area, and yet you're having to come up here weekly, it sounds like.
Yeah, we came up originally when we bought the property. We said, oh, we'll probably come up once a month. Just about every weekend. We're up here about 48 out of 52. And the only ones we didn't come up were like Easter and Mother's Day and Christmas and those. And then Wesley was teaching junior college in Minnesota, freezing to death, and came home over the holidays and decided he really didn't want to go back to the cold where you had to put a heater to keep your car warm at night. And a long-haired boy with an earring really didn't go very well in northern Minnesota. And so he lived in the apartment above what was then the stable, which is now our house, and he sort of took care of it for all those years. And we had a fellow that the prior owner had named Ramon Cisneros, who was a great employee and ultimately became our foreman, and he took care of what needed to be done during the week.
So, for our listeners, Wesley, you're talking about is Wesley Hagen, which is your wife's son.
Yeah,
right. Who eventually became the winemaker and vineyardist of Culpeppy Estate.
Okay. Nepotism and pillow talk have nothing to do with his getting and keeping the job. It has nothing to do with how he's getting compensated. Strictly arm's length transaction.
Well, tell us more about not the nepotism or the pillow talk thing, but tell us more about how here's somebody who didn't really know anything about wine, apparently, or didn't know anything about farming, apparently, and he must have pitched an offer to you, or you pitched an offer to him. How'd that work?
Well, actually, what happened was Jeff Newton agreed to develop the property. We planted the first 14 acres in 96, and at the following Christmas, he came and told us that he was no longer going to be able to farm our property because all of the other property had in this area was down on the Santa Rosa Road, and it took as much time for our 14 or 28 acres as it took for a 100 or 200 acre property. And there's no easy way to get between the Santa Rosa Road and 246. You've got to drive either through Lompoc or Buellton, so it's about an hour. And so he basically fired us all very nice and friendly, and then I said, wow, guess what, Wesley? How'd you like to get a job that pays some money? And Wes agreed to do it. And since we had already done the first planting in 96, we knew basically what we had to order, and Wes took care of the ordering it and getting it. And Ramon and the crew had planted in 96, so they knew the drill on how to put it in. And so they planted the rest of the property in 98. And then Ramon and with Wes farmed it and have been farming it ever since.
For our listeners who may not know the geographical contingencies here, the Santa Rita Hills is sort of anchored at the west end by Lompoc, and at the, well, it, not the AVA, but the two roads that run east-west through this valley, if you will, are anchored at one end by Lompoc and the other end by Bealeton. But like you said, there's no way to get from Santa Rosa Road, which is the southern road, on the 246, which is the northern road. So it was, I can understand where that would be tough for Jeff.
Yeah, it's not like, if you want the analogy, it's not like Highway 29 and the Silverado Trail in Napa, where you have half a dozen crossovers. But even if you get down in the Oakville area, there's one crossover. If you don't get that crossover, you have to go down another 10 or 15 miles before you can get the one just north of Napa. So that was basically the problem. And yeah, Jeff was perfectly straightforward and reasonable. But he's been very helpful ever since. I call him on a regular basis when we have problems or I don't understand something, and he's very generous with his time and never bills me, and occasionally I drop some wine off. So he's been, again, a really great trooper about it.
So, Steve, how did you come to write a book about your experience?
When we planted the backyard vineyard in Long Beach, I said, well, every vineyard has a newsletter, so we got to have a newsletter. So I started a sort of tongue-in-cheek newsletter, and the name Clos Pepe, we had to call the vineyard something, and we called it Clos because Clos in French means enclosure or wall of, and in Burgundy, where there aren't many chateaus, the way they describe the vineyard, instead of saying Chateau Lafite or Chateau Mouton, they say Clos Vougeot or Clos de Mouche or Clos de Tarn, which means the wall of, to describe the vineyard. So the Long Beach house had a wall all the way around it, so we called it Clos Pepe. And then as I started doing all of this, every time I did something, I'd write a newsletter to my friends, sort of like Robert Parker, but never became quite as famous as he did. And so I ended up with about 10 or 20 newsletters from the early days. And then when we moved up here, I continued writing the newsletters for the first 4 or 5 years. And so that was actually the basis of about 80% of the book, is the newsletters that I reorganized and rewrote into a more readable fashion.
And here you were telling us you wrote a book. All you did was copy your newsletters over it.
But I wrote the newsletters. I got some credit for that. And then I hired an editor, Susan Duff, because, well, I'd spent 35 years writing. Legal writing is not the most conducive to readability because we don't use a lot of adjectives or transition sentences or transition paragraphs. And Susan did really a great job of fleshing out the skeleton I gave her, and the readability of it is basically due to Susan. The story's all mine, and the ideas are all mine, but the readability is due to Susan. She's a great editor.
You were telling us earlier that you've got some funny anecdotes and stuff in here in each chapter. Give us one.
Okay, I tried to write the book in a serious but yet a jocular, humorous fashion. And there's at least one chuckle in each chapter and a couple of laughs and belly laughs. But one example, early on we decided to plant the Long Beach vineyard. So I went to all the local nurseries and asked for grape varieties. Oh, sure, we got the Thompson seedless and we got plainness and all these table grapes, and nobody said, I don't know where you can get, Pinot Noir or any of those other grapes. So we said, okay, we'll go up to Napa. So we'll go up to Napa, pull out the yellow pages, and go to the 3 or 4 nurseries and tell them, I want to buy some Pinot Noir. I said, oh, good, how many do you want? And I said, how about 25? He said, what? Yeah, 25. Well, we're not going to sell you 25. Are you crazy? That's not enough. We've got to ship them down, yada, yada. So after about 2 or 3 rejections in Napa, I went over to Sonoma. And at the Sonoma grape line. So I went and told the same story, and he said, 25. Oh, we never sold that few. But hey, you want 25, you can pay the shipping. Fine by us, we'll ship them down to you. And so I bought the grapes from Sonoma, grapevines from Sonoma grapevines. And then 8, 9 years later, when I bought 43,000 grapevines to plant this place, guess where I went? So there's a moral of the story to you business people out there that sometimes pay attention to the acorns, because they do grow into oak trees.
And Steve, you were telling us that you've had some interesting feedback about this book and how readers have actually enjoyed this book as well.
Yeah, I've been surprised at the number of mostly wives, but there are girlfriends of my friends who are males and who enjoy books and enjoy wine. How many of them have gone out of their way to tell me how much they like the book, and if this is the first wine book that their husband ever bought that was really funny and they could understand it and they had a good time? Part of it is, and as you go through the book, Catherine is the straight person and the one who is sensible and reasonable, and I and Wesley are the ones who are sort of bouncing off the walls and coming up with these harebrained schemes. So many of them identify with Catherine, and as I say, there are a lot of funny stories in it about us, about our dogs, and other escapades we've had up here. And I've again been surprised on how many women have really come out of the way to tell me how much they enjoyed reading the book.
Is it fair to assume that you've subtitled this book of Ingeron's Quest for Great Dirt? Does this mean you've found great dirt?
We think so. As you go through it, we started looking in all the usual places. We went to Napa and Sonoma, and no question there are great vineyards up there that make some great Pinots. Problem is, it's pretty pricey. And to get up there on a regular basis, it's easily a 3-day. You can't just turn up there and turn around and come back. We went down to Temecula, looked at Temecula, and they make some pretty good white wine, but we were never impressed with the reds, and we wanted to do Pinot. And then we came up here because we had picked some grapes here, but always on the eastern end of the valley, and didn't know that Pinot would do well here until Jeff said, "Go west, young man." And so we looked around a lot, and we spent a lot of time. Took us about 2 or 3 years, and then there is, as I said, a piece of property on 246 or Santa Rosa, that's a vineyard that we didn't look at or put a bid on or get outbid by somebody or get laughed at because they didn't think our bid was high enough for them. So it took a long time to find the property.
How important is something like, you see, you know, let me start over. How important is it that an area like this become a part, let me start over again. How important is it that an area like this become separated or its uniqueness somehow brought out? I know you guys were at the forefront of coming up with an AVA here. What was it mandatory? Was it needed? Was it necessary? Was it a business decision? Was it just a logical decision to do this?
The idea for the AVA is really Richard Sanford, who is the pioneer. Richard is the one who in the early 1970s came to the valley, rode up and down 246 and the Santa Rosa Road with a thermometer, and noticed that about every mile or two you go from west to east, the temperature changes about a degree. Saw the soil and came convinced that this was going to be a great Pinot Noir area. Of course, planted the Sanford and Benedict vineyard, which is one of the best known, widely acclaimed vineyard. So he's the real pioneer. His idea was the AVA. And as a sidelight, when I was up here in the early 90s, I went around and talked to a lot of the vineyards, and I talked to a well-known, well-regarded vineyard over on Fox Canyon and told them I was going to plant Pinot Noir, and I had a bunch of questions. And where are you going to plant it? I'm going to plant it over on Highway 246. And I said, "You'll never get it right there. You got to plant Riesling. It's too cold over there." So that was even in the mid-90s, there was still a little skepticism about this area. But the AVA was Richard's idea. He spearheaded it, and then Wes and Brian Babcock and Rick Lenore and others pitched in and made it become a reality. But Richard is the real pioneer in this area.
Do you think an AVA is something should be bestowed on an area after it's achieved some notable thing, or do you think it should be some area that should be carved out as an AVA just based on the circumstances and the geography?
Well, as I understand the regulations, the purpose of the AVA is to recognize a unique or distinct growing area, and so they really don't focus on whether what you grow there is going to be great, mediocre, or someplace in between. So I think the answer is if you meet the qualifications of being a unique, distinct growing area, then the AVA makes sense. And the other thing for the consumer, it gives the consumer an identity to say, well, gee, I like X's wine, and that was from the Santa Rita Hills. Oh, here's A's wine, that's from the Santa Rita Hills, and I think I'll try that as well. So it makes it a little easier for the consumer.
experienced before or have no real knowledge of, and it gives them a little bit of a guidepost that this is coming from an area that's known for, in our case, growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Does the book become more interesting to people if they know about Santa Rita Hills or Clos Pepe?
No, I don't get to the Santa Rita Hills until about chapter 10 or 12 or 13 in the back. It's really more about our transitioning from the very fast track of being a lawyer at an international law firm to being a farmer, which is an entirely different lifestyle, because when you're a lawyer, all lawyers who are listening will know this, you spend most of your time defeating geography and time, and you use faxes, you use overnights, you can use all kinds of ways to get things done, and when that doesn't work, you just throw more lawyers at it to get it done. But when you're a farmer, that doesn't work. You've got to wait for Mother Nature, and Mother Nature's not ready. You can't fax it. You can't overnight it. You can't telex it. You can't do anything. You just got to sit there and wait, and you can't throw more people at it at times, because that doesn't work either. So the good part of the book is about that, and the good part is to, you know, when you've reached a retirement age, and you're in relatively good health and relatively secure economically, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And both Kathy and I are looking for a part-time job, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to become growers, because when you're growers, it's basically 6 or 7 months of the year, give or take a week or two on each end, depending on Mother Nature, and you know when there's going to be the down times. And so you can then visit the grandkids, travel, and do all the rest, but it's a good part-time job.
Okay, Steve, this book is available. How can people obtain this book?
Several ways. You can go to our website, which is www.clopepe/bringyourown. And once you do that, you'll get the first chapter. So you can read the first chapter and see if you like it or not. It's on our website, and you can order it there. You can also order it from the Caneros Press. And their website is www.caneraspress.com, and order it through them. And it's in several bookstores in the San Ynez Valley, and it's also in Frohman's bookstore in Pasadena, and it's also in a bookstore in Santa Barbara. So we're slowly expanding where it's available.
Have you got a second book already planned?
I don't think so. I'm waiting for this one and waiting for the call from Oprah and doing the movie rights. And once that's done, then I'll do the second one.
You were talking earlier to us about if you found out how to play the parts in the movie. Go ahead and tell us.
Well, I told Catherine that I thought Anthony Quinn would have been great, but he's dead, so I suggested George Clooney. And Catherine's response was, being in character, that I'd be lucky if I could get Danny DeVito to play me. And then she originally wanted Julia Roberts, but then she saw Sandra Bullock in Blindside. She convinced that only Sandra Bullock could do her justice in this story.
Okay, I'll have to ask this. Who's going to play Wes Hagen?
Wes is convinced that it'll be Johnny Depp. The only problem is somebody's got to be able to teach him to say at least more than one sentence together.
Johnny. Poor Johnny. Well, this is really great. Yeah, I think you've done a fantastic job with this. I just want to know where you're going to, you got to do something for an encore. There's got to be either another chapter that's missing from this, or since you're a newsletter kind of guy, you could put out a newsletter that's an addendum to this if you wanted.
Well, actually, the book starts in the home backyard in 92 and ends in 2000 with Wes and Chanda's wedding. So I've now got from 2000 to 2009 to write the next one if there's enough interest in this one.
Okay. Thanks so much, Steve. Appreciate talking with you, and wish you all the success with Clos Pepe Estate. And we certainly, those of us who enjoy Pinot Noir, have